On the screen. Calgary. Screen's going dead. Okay, to get these presentations up. Okay, let's get started. Good morning, everybody. This is the DNS Working Group in our first session at Right for tonight. I hope everyone's wide awake, especially after the lovely party we had last night, thanks to the Links people. But before we get started, we've got one or two announcements and things to make. As usual, I would ask people to take their pagers, mobile phones, and either switch them off or turn them into silent mode. That would be appreciated. Thanks very much. The sessions are being audio cast and webcast, so I'd appreciate it that whenever people have any questions, that they would state their name and affiliation, and most importantly of all, use the microphone so that they can be heard. If you just shout something from the back of the room, the people out there in webland won't hear it, and they won't hear the question or who's asking it, so I'd appreciate it if you come forward. Can I check with someone here from Ripe NCC acting as scribe? Okay, thank you. I've got that taken care of. I'm also looking for a volunteer to look after the Jabber session. So we're looking for someone to describe what's taking place and inform us of any questions that are coming on through the Jabber channels that we could then relay to the meeting. Do we have any takers for this? Okay, well, my apologies for that. Tonight we're just looking for the Jabber session. No one seems to be available at the moment, but if someone does come forward, I would much appreciate it. Next thing is, before we get down to business, there's been one or two small changes to the agenda that was originally published and the agenda that's on the website just now. So Yap Packard House's presentation on the SECSAC information and report will be in the second session on Thursday, and his other presentation that was scheduled for the Thursday slot, the second Thursday slot, has been dropped. So Yap will not be giving the presentation on the implications of what happens with ns.eu.net. That will probably be held over until Ripe 50. So in the space that was vacated on the Thursday morning, Olaf is going to give us an update on the Dizzy project and various other DNSSEC developments. That takes care of the most significant agenda change. And the other agenda change I have is that it's a change of speaker, that instead of Leslie Daigle giving us an update on what's been happening in the CRISP working group at ITF, that's going to be given by David Blacker from VeriSign Labs. So let's say thank you to David for that. Next thing is, quite simply, the minutes of the last meeting. I think we've all read them. Can I have a hum or a nod of approval that the minutes of the last meeting are acceptable to everybody? Okay, thank you. That's enough. That's enough humming. So we'll now get down to business, and the first item of business for today There's updates on the various DNS DNS and DNS related working groups at IETF. So Sam is going to give us the update on what's been happening in the DNSX and DNS Ops working group. Sam.
Okay. Thank you, John. DNSX, DNS Extensions Working Group, since my last report when I was in Amsterdam in May, the DNSSEC biz docs, all 116 pages of them, are in IETF last call, having passed working group last call. And I don't see any of the editors in the room, so I don't have people to call up to stand up and take a round of applause. I do have a working group here. Good job, all. Jakob, who is in the room, did some interoperability testing for the unknown RR types RFC to get that progressed from proposed standard to draft standard. So let's give him a round of applause. Thank you for stepping up and doing that. And four DNSSEC-related RFCs have been published. DNS threats is mostly a requirement document. The NSEC RData document allows the NSEC record to secure DNS type codes beyond 127. We have a 16-bit type space. Only 7 bits of it were protectable with DNSSEC because of an early, perhaps poor design limitation. We fixed that. Security entry point flag is not a algorithm or protocol change, but it helps write DNS key management tools. And the type code role fixed some problems that DS introduced or exposed. So DNSX has made quite a bit of progress in getting its documents out. New work has taken on. At the last meeting in San Diego, at the 1st of August, there was agreement to take on an API for DNSSEC information. As far as I know, no editor has been found for that document, and the chairs were looking for volunteers as of that meeting. Olaf seems to be nodding, so I assume that's still the case. There was a lot of discussion about DNSSEC key management, trust anchor management. There were 3 proposals talked about at the meeting. None are working group documents, but the working group is interested in these if you want to bring new proposals in. There are several minor new drafts that I don't think are much worthy of mention. There's a server ID proposal for identifying name servers. This is useful to people who are doing measurement activities, operating perhaps any casted zones and needing to do diagnostics. A new proposal from Rob Austin. And the remaining work items are mostly advancing the large mass of proposed standards RFC to draft. We need volunteers to do interoperability testing. Jakob, how much work was it to do the MNRR's interop testing? 3 or 4 days and want to get an RFC pushed up to draft standard. Speak to Olaf. The other new work item is zone enumeration. A bunch of folks have come forward saying that because the DNSSEC specs allow zones to be walked, it essentially makes a chain of all the records in a zone. It makes it easy to do a zone transfer the effect of a zone transfer even when that's disabled. Some folks have come forward and said this is a problem. It's not clear how widespread that problem is. There's an effort afoot to collect requirements. Ben Laurie is working with Nominet, and Rip Loomis are collecting requirements and should have a doc out soon. If you have requirements in this space, if you think that having people be able to walk through your zone and see all the records is a problem, send text to these gentlemen. The working group decided that DNSSEC they should move forward anyway. We spent some time figuring out, yes, we have mechanisms to expand the protocol later if we need to. There are extension mechanisms available. And enough people care about DNSSEC and don't have problems with zone walking that we should go ahead and push it out. That zone walking could be a big enough problem to solve that would delay the whole thing significantly. We do have some technical proposals for addressing it. I don't think they're all that mature, though they may be feasible. But the big takeaway here is requirements. If you run zones that you have the sort of requirement for, please send text to these gentlemen. DNS Ops, DNS Operations Working Group. Back at the Seoul meeting in Seoul, Korea in March, the ISG had said, y'all aren't getting anywhere with V6 configuration and discovery. We need you to figure something out. And they said, write a document that describes the various approaches so that we can look at this in with some coherency. And if you don't get that done by August, we're going to take this item entirely off your charter. You can't work on it. That doc did come out. It's in working group last call. It ends tomorrow. Going back, the DNSSEC biz documents are in IETF last call. That ends on Friday. One RFC is almost out from that working group. I think that's Johan's document. It's also in the room. Good job. But otherwise, it doesn't seem like much is happening in DNS Ops. If you leave off the working group minutes messages and other mass trivia, we have about, two messages a week coming out of the working group. It's not a good sign. There are a bunch of open drafts. There's a new one that's not a working group document from Scott Hollenbeck, adding extensions to EPP to support moving DNSSEC keying material. If you are a registry or a registrar planning on doing DNSSEC, you might want to take a look at that. I think the DNSSEC operational practices document is interesting. It needs some more review. There's a server ID draft in DNS Ops. This is distinct from the one in DNSSEC. This one documents current practice only. Particularly if you've been doing measurement and then looking at what kinds of servers people are using, you might have some comments on this one. My last day of this report in May, there were two documents that were in working group last call, two more about to go to it. I don't think anything has happened with any of those. DNS Ops is pretty stagnant. Physical meetings. Last meeting was in San Diego. I've been telling you what happened there and since. The next meeting is in November in Washington, D.C. Beware if you are not carrying a U.S. passport, you may get fingerprinted at the border. The IETF list has a significant discussion about this and about future meeting venues going on. The following meetings have not been announced. The venues have not been announced. The IETF restructuring effort would impact that. Again, discussion on the IETF list. So, your takeaway items as a group. If you have anti-enumeration requirements, please send them to Ben Laurie, Rip Loomis, or to name droppers. There's a lot of interoperability work in DNSX that needs to be done. A document editor is needed by DNSX for DNSSEC API requirements. And there are a bunch of docs to review. The documents that are in DNS Ops mostly haven't progressed because people haven't been reading them. Many of these are your colleagues from the RIPE region who have been writing the documents. Comments from the room, people who have docs on this list who want to say things about them? Guess not.
Can you state your name for the minute takers? That's a general question. I know Suzanne, but I might not have a question.
Yeah, I'm still Suzanne. I'm Suzanne Wolf from ISC. It doesn't appear on that list, but the DNSSEC server ID draft didn't appear on the to-do list. I especially want to ask people, though, the server document in DNSSEC is requirements. It's input to DNSX doing something about a replacement for the hostname.bind hack that's been so widely deployed and everybody hates, but it's the only thing we have. There is an operational need for a better way to identify which server you're talking to in an Anycast cloud or for measurement purposes, but we need requirements. You know, DNSX is trying to do the right thing, which is determine requirements before doing protocol. but we do need people to review the draft and send me suggestions. I want to roll a new version before the deadline for Washington, and I hope to see the next version of the draft go to last call. So send requirements to me over the mailing list.
No more questions for Sam? Okay, thank you very much, Sam. Next speaker is another slight change we have, is that I forgot to mention earlier, is that the MARAD report, so the report from the MARAD Working Group, will be given by Peter Koch and not by Ed Lewis. So over to Peter. How do you get this? Close. There we go. Close this. Right, who knows how to use Acrobat on a PC? How do you get rid of this presentation? Okay, let me close it.
Good morning, everyone. So I'm going to talk about MARAD. MARAD is a working group which is doing multiple attempts to do rather interesting things in the DNS, which is what the acronym is from. Well, really, it's about MTA authorization records in the DNS. The working group is chaired by Andy Newton from VeriSign and Marshall Tree Rose from himself. And it's about support for anti-spam measures in and with the DNS infrastructure. I'll have a couple of slides on the basic idea because I'm not sure everybody knows what the group is about. This is for the administrivia, like you find the charter there and the mailing list. But be warned, the working group has a very ambitious timeline. It's almost about to close. Well, see about that later. And the mailing list is very high volume, which is roughly 60 mails per day. There's lots of discussion on the contents of the drafts and proposals, lots of discussion about the DNS issues, and lots of discussion about patent claims and conspiracy theories and this kind of things. Nonetheless, in this report, I will try to concentrate on the DNS issues. The basic idea is that given spam is bad, and spam uses all kinds of forgery, one wants to try to establish some trust in the actual sender of a mail message to do whatever one wants to do with that. See about that later. So given the sender address, however that might be determined, the question is the current SMTP peer, that is the client who is talking to your server, is that SMTP peer authorized to send that email? Like in, if someone is trying to deliver a to deliver a mail from someone at right.net, you have the IP address of that incoming connection from that remote SMTP peer, and you want to check, well, is it reasonable that this one is sending me mails from right.net? So you more or less need a list of outgoing mail servers for that particular domain, like right.net. This is the one-step, first-step approach. If you look a bit deeper into this, you will find out that, well, there are things like mail forwarding and roaming. Roaming meaning that people walk around, like, traveling to conferences and still use their email address, someone at right.net, although they may or may not use a different mail server to send their mail, to inject their mail into the global mail system. So there are some considerations in the working group how to determine who the real mail sender is and how to connect that to a particular IP address or that SMTP server, client working from that IP address. Once you have determined that a particular system may be authorized to send mail using from addresses or, say, senders at a certain domain name, that not necessarily means that the mail is not spam. Because, well, just because you know someone is Hannibal Lecter, you don't know he's really good to you. So what you still need is, or may need, is an additional service, which is some kind of reputation service. So some entity you can ask, well, this guy who I have identified as Hannibal Lecter, will he be good for me? And the answer may depend on who you ask. But this is outside of the scope of this report, because it's not about the DNS issues. So, examples. Thanks. So this is how it might look like. This is live data. I hope I'm not being sued for reproducing it here. There's lots of patent and intellectual property claims in there. So all these claims apply. The first attempt by Microsoft was to use the DNS and especially use text records to distribute XML documents. These XML documents you see here, they contain a level of indirection. If you go to these domain names and ask there for underscore ep.list1.underscore ep.hotmail.com and the other two, you will find another set of XML documents which actually describe a complete set of sender policy. This is one approach. The other one is SPF, which was sender permitted from and is now the sender policy framework. Is that right? Okay. And this is mainly a list of IP addresses, or say address ranges, and they may be IPv4 addresses, or they may also be IPv6 addresses, or you see in the lower line there's also the opportunity to use again another level of indirection into the DNS, like saying all the MX systems for AOL.com can act as a sender, as an initiator for SMTP connections sending in mails claiming to be from AOL.com. And there are a couple of other companies and private internet users and organizations already using this SPF stuff. One fine thing is, you see here there's a kind of a, oh, thanks. Kind of laser sword. Yeah, whatever. Yeah, sure. okay, levels of indirection, and the final one kind of says that, well, we don't know about all the others. So we have a list of IP addresses which are allowed, and we don't know about the others. There are several opportunities to declare if a certain IP address or host name is or is not allowed, or is known not to be allowed to send mail originating from a certain domain. So these are two similar but kind of different approaches. The working group in its earlier being has already decided to, well, they looked at the caller ID proposal, which is what is from Microsoft, SPF, and they somehow combined it into something which then was called sender ID, and yesterday I read on the mailing list that sender ID should no longer be used as a term because there's a trademark claim on it and so on and so forth. So I am going to be sued by someone for having this on the slide, but, well, nonetheless. The XML in text, which was a great idea, has been withdrawn so far. So what the working group is mainly concerned with is continued work on what was in the lower example, like the SPF thing. There have been different approaches. You may have heard of the RMX record approach, which is rather similar to SPF, or MTA mark, which tries to use the reverse mapping, the in-other ARPA domain, and tries to use a flag. Pardon me?
There is a significant amount of ringing, i.e. the speakers are making it very irritating for some of the speakers. That's the bad.
Okay. Okay, so MTA Mark is using the reverse mapping and is just flagging or trying to flag the system using this particular IP address is allowed to send mail regardless of the originating sender, which mainly approaches or tries to approach the say DSLN cable modem spam injection problem. But this approach has not been looked at very deeply by the working group, and they're concentrating on this SBF or sender ID style approach. So what is the status of the working group? Four internet drafts have been last called starting on August 23rd. The last call, usually the working group last calls in the ITF last 14 days. And that last call, that particular last call, has, due to the volume on the mailing list and the number of issues raised, mainly the patent stuff, but also technical issues, has been extended by a couple of days. That is 10th of September. One day later, on Saturday, 11th September, 9/11, the chairs judged kind of consensus on certain points, and came forward with a slightly changed working plan, mainly because the patent-encumbered, I should put that in quotes, approach has been abandoned or was not, there was no chance of a almost rough consensus proceeding with this one. So, new and one new document and the protocol document as a revised one have been posted to the Internet Drafts Archive last week, and they probably will be subject to further discussion, and I guess a modified last call will be issued real soon now, or in 6 months or whatever. So as a reaction to these patent problems, multiple so-called scopes have been proposed to overcome the patent problems, and this is why the so-called mail from draft mentioned earlier has been added to the set of documents. These scopes include the PRA, the purported responsible address approach, which is the one probably patent encumbered, and they do have alternative approaches like the mail from, and there will really probably be no mandatory algorithm. Usually the ITF, when it comes to algorithms, be they encumbered or be they controversial in any case, mostly we have to deal with that when it comes to cryptography. There's usually one mandatory to implement algorithm. In this case, there may not be one. So there are some concerns that there may be some fragmentation of the net, which is subject to further discussion, because if one part of the net is using this algorithm and the other part is using that, they may or may not be able to communicate. This is still a bit contentious because there are various claims that either side of using the algorithm, like I may be able to announce the information to be used by PRA that may or may not be patent encumbered, whereas the implementation on the SMTP server side, which actually uses the DNS records and applies the algorithm, is actually really patent encumbered. So that's a thing to watch it. The whole mail forwarding issue is still really contentious, because to overcome the problem that, if I receive mail from someone at ripe.net, I forward it to another mail server. My home mail server is, of course, not allowed to send or to originate mails from ripe.net. So what the working group documents propose is that some headers be rewritten in the process of forwarding, which actually doesn't happen in internet email. So there are some problems to deal with. And finally, since this is a DNS working group, there are lots of funny things related to the DNS. The first being, you saw in the examples that they're using text records, and they still propose using text records. We will hear Patrick in a minute about this topic. So it's still open whether there is a mandatory dedicated RR type or whether it is allowed to live with a transition period where we have to deal with both a text record and the newly defined and then deployed RR type. There has been lots of discussion about the applicability of new RR types. Can they be deployed? Can they not be deployed? We early heard about Jakob's efforts to do RFC 3597 interoperability tests and deployment. So this is an issue which needs some more work. There's also been discussion about using an application-specific prefix, like in the SRV record, underscore merit or underscore SPF dot something. The declared consensus has been that such a prefix not be used, but after the consensus has been declared, of course, voices to the contrary have been raised. Once one would decide to go with a dedicated RR type, the question comes up, what encoding is used? Because currently the proposal is, well, we start with a text record, we use the text record encoding, and if we have to define a specific RR type, we just copy the text record encoding and do nothing else. This, of course, has problems with efficiency, because you saw the list of IP addresses, which, of course, can be more compactly defined than in an ASCII representation, and this will, I suppose, be subject to further discussion. During the IETF meeting, there has been a lot of discussion about wildcards, how they actually work and how they may or may not apply to problems here, because lots of domains use wildcard MX records. Is there any need to use wildcards, SPF, or text records? What about prefixes and wildcards? DNS working groups have meanwhile decided that this is probably not a very good idea. So it came to rather basic DNS questions, and this is, in my opinion, one of the problems of that working group. They probably need more DNS people watching at that. Yeah, thanks. I talked about encoding, so response sizes are an issue. The question is, can we rely upon eDNS being available, or can't we? The overall complexity and the levels of indirection I had on the slides raises concerns, as does the provisioning issue. For the average zone administrator, it may be a bit complicated to manually install text or whatever records. So the question is, can we have tools available in time? And there was lots of discussion that my favorite DNS provider doesn't support anything else but text records, so we can't use new record types. And this also delays, of course, any serious decision. And maybe the remaining question is, could or even should this drive DNSSEC? Spammers are criminals. Spammers are forging anything from addresses, any headers, IP addresses. So why shouldn't they, once something like this has been deployed, why shouldn't they start doing attacks on the DNS and forging text records or whatever is defined there? Okay, that's mainly it. Any questions or even answers? I would like to encourage you to read that mailing list.
No question.
I won't name names.
Come on, it's only 60 messages. That's nothing. No more quite other.
Solves the problem.
Well, if you're getting plenty more spam, well, another 60 messages isn't going to make much difference.
Reduces the percentage of spam you get by
Okay. Bill, could you use the mic, please? Jerry Springer? Jimmy? No.
Jeff Williams. Bill Manning. Go back a slide, if you would, please.
Sure.
Why is DNSSEC applicable here at all? Are we simply is the attempt to protect the integrity of the record? Or, DNS is a lookup service. And if people are going to go through and attack the DNS, even if it's signed, there are other ways to attack. Until the application can take advantage of that. DNSSEC, this is a red herring. Right?
Well, this is all about red herrings, but as I said, spammers forge everything. And once these, say, reputation services may or may not have been deployed, it may be valuable to not only forge the sender address of, say, ep.net, but also to be able to say, well, this IP address I'm currently using, that rooted host in northern nowhere, is allowed to send mail originating from ep.net. So I can subvert your good reputation, Bill.
I'm sorry I got stuck on the subverting my good reputation. That's been gone a long time.
Don't take it personal.
But spammers can do that now. The problem is not in the DNS necessarily, the problem is in the mail agents. The mail agents are unable to check or verify or validate DNSSEC capable stuff. It's kind of pointless.
You mean they are currently unable?
They're currently unable, and so even if DNSSEC is deployed, it won't be helpful, I don't think.
Well,
the argument I think is...
I'm sorry, your name is? For the note takers?
I think the argument is that once this is deployed, spammers will attack the DNS to get their spam mail through.
They do that now.
Exactly, but much less. This will be a hard target at that moment because this is one of the attack vectors. And that would drive DNSSEC deployment.
But maybe I'm wrong. You're already specialists.
Leslie?
Yeah, Leslie Needle. One other attempt at trying to clarify it. I think the point is that pursuing this basically makes the DNS an integral part of expressing what is legitimately part of a mail path, which is why it becomes an interesting target. And the issue is that in order to implement any of the marriage stuff, MTAs are going to have to change anyway. They're going to be basically processing these things in order to determine whether or not what they want to do with mail. It's not a huge jump to move from that extended processing to saying, fine, if you actually want to believe the data that you've now imported, looked up for this process, you should also implement DNSSEC checking code in order to actually determine whether or not it's sound. I mean, I think that's the train of thought that is captured in the last bullet. Not just that, you know, implementing DNSSEC and all will be well.
You're so much more eloquent than I am.
Patrick Feldstrom, deploying DNSSEC does not imply only that you put DNSSEC and signed records in the DNS. It also implies that you actually have to have tools that actually verifies that data, including applications.
I guess that this is Bill Manning again before Olaf asks me. I actually think that we can get DNSSEC deployed before MARID makes its way through the rest of that bullet list. And I really don't want to wait any longer for DNSSEC deployment.
We're going to deploy like DNSSEC in the next 6 months, aren't we?
next 6 years. The next question, I think, actually is a straight man lead into Patrick. On and off, I have paid attention to TXT records as a replacement for the last 10 years.
Hi, Sir Bill. That nicely segues into something we're just about to slip into the agenda. Patrick's actually got a little bit of an extra presentation here, so we're giving you an extra free presentation in the working group.
Is this supposed to work just if I plug it in somewhere?
I have no idea. So probably this would have been better to have gone in under any other business on Thursday's session, but since it's relevant to the discussion of what's been happening in the married group, we thought it would be best to try and do it here.
So how do I... Oh. Look here.
It works.
It looks like it works. Ta-da!
Okay, Patrick.
Okay, so what I will talk about here has to do with the use of DNS records, or rather, what I will talk about is all of these people, there, all of those people, including myself, that want to store information in DNS that is not really DNS data. So, how to do this? A lot of people try to invent their own ways of doing it. Good or bad, you can add new data in different ways. We have already, with the SRV record and a PTR record, done it in two different ways. We just saw that some married people try to do it by putting stuff in the TXT record. You ask people, how should I do this? And you get different responses. This is confusing. So Rob Austin and myself felt we had to write a document that discussed the alternatives. And what happened now is that the IAB a few weeks back decided that it should actually become an IAB statement, an IAB document, which means that I actually have to update this. Excuse me? Okay, Leslie had some comments there. Leslie is the IAB chair. Anyways, so this actually means that I actually have to finish this document. So I promise to come up with a new version under this week. But anyways, what is more important is that I actually get input from the community. So I'm here to announce this document and make sure that you actually come with comments on it. So the... let's see, five different alternatives we are discussing in this document has to do with placing selectors inside the R data, add a prefix to the owner name, add a suffix to the owner name, add a new class, and add a new resource record type. And then the document goes through the good things and bad things with each one of these alternatives, and the conclusion is that adding a new resource record type is the preferred method of moving forward. So what I mean by each one of these is that if you have selectors inside the R data, this is what people try to do with TXT records. This is what we did with MAPTR records, is doing this. This implies that when you're querying, you get the whole resource record set, then you have to walk through the records and select the word records that you actually want. So the size of the R set will grow, etc. And for a specific resource record type, it's probably the case that we need a registry for these selectors. That is something we have for the NAPTR records. We don't have that for the TXT record type. The second alternative is to add a prefix to the owner name that you, for example, like the SRV record is doing. But of course, that implies that you can query directly for the record you actually want. But the problem here is, of course, that you can get potential collisions with existing or new subdomains for, in this case, example.com. You can also add a suffix to the owner name and also query directly for the various records you want. This is something that various people think is a really good idea when they try to register new top-level domains. But this, of course, makes synchronization with example.com domain really hard, because you actually have then synchronization problems between two different branches in the DNS hierarchy. You can add a new class, and of course, as well, query it directly for the record you want. But a new class implies a new root, and implications of new roots is I've talked to various people on how to handle a new class in the correct way, and that's a new root. You have to have new NS records, etc., because following the path in the IN class and NS records down to a specific zone, and then query for something in a different class inside of that zone, that seems to be a little bit unclear whether that is really the right way of doing things, if you're going to do things the right way. So this is sort of, as I can see it, unknown territory. But there's more text in the document itself, of course, for each one of them. And then you can have a new resource record type and query for the record you want directly. And we have RFC 3597 now, as you heard about a few minutes ago, that specifies how to handle unknown resource record types. I remember when we, I was one of the persons that actually came up with the MAPTR record, and I remember when I talked to DNS people at that time, they said, it's okay to add new resource record types is bad. Nowadays, adding new resource record types is good. So we have also seen on the work that Jakob has done and others that implementation that are confirmed to RFC 3597 is high, but of course some implementations of DNS-like mechanisms do not support RFC 3597. On the other hand, it seems that the community agree that support of RFC 3597 is really important for applications, so they should actually be conformant. So given that people implement RFC 3597, adding a new resource record type is the best way of moving forward. So, but the name of the draft at the moment is draft-ymbk DNS choices. The new name of the draft will be draft-ib-dns-choices. But I want Rob and myself, at least myself, want to have comments on this. So please read this and come with comments. Thanks.
Thank you, Patrick. Are there any questions for Patrick? Actually, I have one.
Okay.
When's your best guess when this IB statement will actually be published as a finalized as a final document?
I think to be really honest, that is something that I want you to tell me after you have read the document. The better you think the document is, the faster it will pass. If it is the case that you and others think that we have to do a major rewrite, because this is only the first version that we wrote. We have not got major comments that it is completely wacky, which means that I think it can go pretty fast. I have time and resources to do updates pretty quickly, so I think it will go pretty fast.
Okay, thank you.
Olaf, do I understand? I haven't read the document. Do I understand correctly that IAB will not give a recommendation but only provide the choices? Okay.
I heard the answer was yes from Leslie.
Good. Then I also know the answer to that.
This is Bill.
Sorry, that's what
I did. Maybe it's Jim, I'm not sure. Carl Denninger, no. The question about unknown RR types really has to be dealt with at the application level. Just because the DNS knows how to successfully deal with the fact that it doesn't know about the RR type, the application, what people like Merritt and other folks want to do is they want to be able to signal to the application. So having an unknown RR type presented, the application then has to say, I have to scan through all of the unknown RR types that are presented to find the one I want. So it's effectively the same problem.
Well, not really, because there is a large number of hosts out there that do not issue DNS queries. But they use other protocols as front end to DNS.
The front end,
and that is the problem. Like Yellow Pages, like the Microsoft RPC libraries, etc.
Okay.
That is what I'm talking about.
All right.
If the application can issue DNS queries directly, absolutely, I agree with you. But the unknown RR types is not only an application thing. It also has to do with how with everything between the application, or rather everything between the part of the application that know how to parse the unknown resource record down to whatever passes the bits over the wire. Everything in between.
Makes me like address literals more and more. The other, I guess, thing that sort of tweaked the chain was there are a number of studies that have been done on the distribution or the diffusion of supported software. And you said that there are the implementations that support whatever this new RFC is, RFC 35 something?
97, yeah.
3597 is high. What is high? What is the distribution? Can you give me a rough percentage, and can you back it?
When I say hi, it of course depends on, as you're saying, it depends on where you're looking, what you're looking for, etc.
Yeah.
If you look at the case for married, what is important is to look at the support for 3597 in the hosts that actually do accept incoming SMTP, which is TCP over port 25, which means that they already have a hole in the firewall to that host.
Mm-hmm.
So on those hosts, the number of hosts that can implement that and applications is... To be really honest, I've asked for an example and pointed to some hosts that cannot implement 3597 by itself by sending UDP packets. That is that kind of host. On the other hand, I know that there are a lot of, for example, Windows clients that are leaf nodes that are behind that use this Microsoft RPC protocol that talk with a firewall that is the translator between the RPC protocol and DNS, and that firewall do not let DNS query through. The amount of those leaf nodes is high. But when I say high, I'm more talking about the number of applications, not the number of nodes.
Okay, I'm sorry, I have to interrupt here. We're running a little bit over time, so perhaps this discussion could be continued in the coffee break. I'd like to try and get things back on track if we possibly could. Thank you, Patrick. Thank you, Bill. And thank you to everybody else for the questions and contributions. Next up, we have David Blacker from VeriSign Labs, who's going to tell us about what's been going on in the CRISP working group.
When we met in San Diego, at that point, the main original work for CRISP is essentially done. We have submitted the domain name space and the core documents to the ISG, and they've been approved, and they're just waiting for numbers. Sure. Right now, the working group is moving on to the address space, and that is where really work is. Right now, one of the main things we're talking about is really what the query model is and really how you query for different network blocks based on different criteria. And right now, we're starting essentially with what write does and their who is. That's where these terms, less, these, more, most, came from, essentially. The other work that we're doing is this IRS over UDP stuff, which is right now in this DCheck document that is really talking also about this domain check stuff, which I think is on the following slide. But the IRS over UDP stuff is really not tied to DCheck. It could be used for any number of things, and so it will be split out into its own draft. You certainly have heard a lot of interest in doing this sort of stuff over UDP, because when we look at who is traffic, we notice that there's a lot of really small responses, or reasonably small responses. It can use deflate. The client can indicate how big they think the response packets can be. The other part of that draft is this domain name availability check thing, and it's really a very stripped-down version of the core domain name space stuff in CRISP. It's like we basically just removed everything except for one query and a very, very small response. But the idea is that this might be an application that is used perhaps more often, and it might want to separate it out and do it more efficiently. There is software for all this stuff. There will be something for the domain name side on CommonNet at some point soon. That's the URL. And that's it. Oh. Yes, actually, I wrote some of the stuff, so.
So anybody's got questions about it? said, right, you've got a good license, and then you're right here if I'm talking with me.
Right.
Catching all those jet lags.
Right. Anyway. Jim? Yeah, so.
Okay, no more questions for David? Okay, thank you very much. Next up we have Marcus Forey from COD, who's going to give us information on what's been happening in the Council for European Registrars. Oops. I'm clearly Windows challenged, so please bear with me.
Okay, thanks. Hi, I'm Max Faure. I'm with COA Internet Council of Registrars, and I'm talking about two topics today. One is the upcoming registrar exchange that we will have inside of COA, and the second is the ICANN WHOIS data reminder policy. The first one is a little bit of advertising, but as we are a non-profit, I think that's okay. The second one is more on the technical side. As an introduction to the first topic, I'll give you a short overview of what COA is. COA was established in 1997 as a non-profit association under Swiss law, and the goal was to offer alternatives to the NSI monopoly that existed at that time. You may remember that the common net registrations cost $70 at that time. We had the plan of establishing 7 new TLDs. You may remember .web, .reg, .shop, stuff like that. Well, that didn't turn out, but the result was, one of the results was that ICANN was created, and COA was a testbed, one of the first 5 testbed registrars that could alternatively offer .com, .net, and .org registrations. And today we have an ongoing process of introducing new TLDs to the root. The most popular that are established already are .info and .biz, where COA is also involved as a founding member of Afilias. So today COA is the largest non-profit registrar worldwide, and it offers a variety of domain names to its members through a single interface. And it also, in line with its original intention, offers registry services. It's the registry operator of .arrow and .museum, and it's also active in a number of TLD bits, .nom and .eu, that have been in the past, and one of the future bits is .cat, not .cat. It has nothing to do with cats and dogs. It's for the Catalan-speaking community in Spain and other Latin American countries. And we're also active in the policy building process right now with CETA, who is the sponsor of .arrow. The COA membership is open and non-discriminatory, and we also show responsibility as we have benefits for non-OECD countries, so people from that spaces will have lower membership fees. We have 80 members worldwide, and the range is from small ISPs to national telcos. So that leads us to the registrar exchange. We have seen a process of, as we have many technical companies as members, we have seen a process that some members needed special services, and they found that within the COA community, other members were offering that. So the natural idea was, why not bring that informal process of approaching another member through the mailing list or the contact data, why not ease that process and introduce the COA registrar exchange, which brings those people together. So the idea is to have COA in the middle. The provider, I call it provider now for clarity, most of our members are providers, but the provider is now the one who offers the service, and the customer is probably not the end customer, but another provider who acts on behalf of the end customer. So if, for example, one provider offers .de domain registrations, which are not offered by COA itself, the provider is encouraged to propagate this on the core registrar exchange platform, and the other core member can then go into the categories, find someone who registers .de and select from that list. So the transaction would be pretty straightforward. The specification that has been uploaded by the provider can be downloaded by the customer. The customer would send the registration template to the registrar exchange platform with a number of different transport mechanisms at hand. The core system sends a confirmation to the requesting member, informs the providing member. The provider would then register the .de domain, send back the success message to core, and core then informs the customer and forward the funds to the provider. So the benefit of having core in between is A, it will be easy for you to find someone who offers service, and B, you have a transaction witness in between, and C, you don't have to care about the fund handling because that has been prepaid by the customer and will be forwarded to your account. Number of possible services. You can offer any internet-related services that are not offered by a main core system itself. And now we're back to DNS. You can, for example, offer specialized DNS services like multicast DNS service or ultra-fast DNS service in certain spaces, China, Thailand, whatever. You can offer outsourced web hosting, VPN solutions, broadband access, whatever you can imagine. So, if you're interested in that, the service will start in Q1 or Q2 2005. And all you have to do is become a core member, upload specification to the website, and then be ready to answer queries. So, any questions so far?
Whatever I can imagine.
Yeah, that's internet. With the restriction, it should be internet related because you will be in a difficult position to find customers if it's not internet related.
I'm kind of a bit amazed by the numbers you're pushing out. You said you have 80 members, yes? And if I only count the ICANN accredited registrars, you already have double the figure. In the Netherlands, you have about 1,800 registrars. And Germany, a couple of hundreds. And I mean, you want to be go-between all these people, but they're not member yet. I don't get it. It looks like you're creating some kind of vehicle which is doing the same as the failed micro-payment industry.
We have seen a great interest on the membership, and right now we have a very informal process for that. So the idea was not just to say, oh, we now must have 1,000 members or something. The need for that is already there, and it's inside the core platform. And now we would like to spread that idea to anyone who likes to participate in it.
Still, it's kind of strange because I know outfits who are offering registration in nearly all of the TODs around, and I mean, so why go to yet another extra loop and an extra model of failure?
Well, I'm sorry I could not attract you as a core member, but I know that the interest is there, so.
I'm not a registrar, so there's no point in.
I
don't see any reason for any registrar to become a member, but that might be me.
Well, that may be, you may not see that, but obviously some people at core obviously do see, some registrars do see benefit because they're members. Any more questions for Marcus? No?
Okay, second topic. The more technical one, ICANN Swiss Data Reminder Policy. Next thing when you talk about DNS is, of course, talking about the WHOIS. The WHOIS is a public resource. You can't stress that often enough because you will be amazed how many domain name holders are not aware of that, that their data is published somewhere in a public space on the internet and can be queried by anyone. So just spend a day in the support department of a company and you will learn that experience. Yahoo is displays legal technical contact information for given domain name. However, an increasing problem is that the accuracy of the Yahoo's information is dropping, which creates legal and technical problems. Legal, because you may have a claim that some domain name was registered fraudulently, and technical, because that domain is not working and you cannot transfer that domain. So ICANN went and thought we have to introduce some countermeasures, and that would be the Whois data reminder policy. And the idea behind is that the ICANN accredited registrars are bound to send a reminder to the registrant on a yearly basis and say, well, this is your Whois information, please check if that is still correct. However, a problem that comes with that is that the method is not specified, but today most providers are using email to send out their reminders, which is natural because they are providers and email is the most cost-effective solution to reach the end customers. Possible positive effects of that is that the accuracy of the Whois information is improved, and I say possible here because that service is pretty young and not even all registrars are doing that right now, so we don't have any experience how the results will look like. There's a possible saving potential for the registrars because it's of course easier to deal with a domain that has accurate data than to deal with a domain that doesn't have that. And there's an increased registrant awareness where their data is used and what it should look like. So the possible negative effects on the other side, every registrar has to develop this system, and actually there's a big problem with thin registries, and we recently learned that VeriSign will have .com and .net, if they continue to manage .net, will have .com and .net as a thin registry, which means that the registry itself does not have the Whois information, but the respective registrar has it, and as we don't have a standardized Whois around, we will have much fun writing Whois parsers for each and every domain registrar that is around. So the other possible negative effect is that it will be very difficult for you to correct an incorrect email address by sending an email. And so especially the domain transfers that are usually handled by an email process will not become easier, and that situation is even going to be more difficult with the new ICANN transfer policy that becomes effective in November, makes it mandatory for you to have an email process and to inform the registrant before transfer takes place. So the results of it, they are now uncertain because the WDRP is still very young. We think that there will be improvement for legal issues, that the legal addresses will have some improvement regarding accuracy, but we also think that there is very little improvement for today's transfers, and that tomorrow's transfers will be even more difficult. So, questions on that?
Change questions on internet. Doesn't this make fishing trips a lot easier for other people because they're now going to expect to get an email saying, yeah, you've got to do this every year?
Yeah, one of the problems is that, of course, the awareness of the registrants is so much lowered by spam today that this might look like another spam mail. There are, of course, recommendations that you should give a lot of information in your reminder mail so that the customer is aware, oh, this does not look like spam. That guy has so much information about me. He must be related to me in some kind. But, of course, this also breaks it's difficult for some registrars as they have a reseller structure and the end customer only knows the reseller but not the registrar itself. However, the registrar has the responsibility that the registrant is informed.
Question from Steve.
Hi, it's Steve Dyer from Inobi. The time it takes for somebody to change an address in the UK on average is about 8 years. So that means that every year...
Is that an IP address or is that change an IP address?
No, house address,
okay.
Postal address. I don't know what the figure is for email address, but I guess it might be fairly similar given people move providers and providers get taken over by other providers. So I'm kind of assuming that 1/12, if you like, one-eighth of who is addresses will go wrong every year unless they're corrected. So by now, probably something like 40, 50, 60% of an average registry is wrong already. So around about half of the messages you send out won't get to the people who have the wrong addresses, but they will get to the people who have the right addresses who don't have to do anything because they've got the right address. So I'm just wondering if this really is going to work.
I don't think so. But this is ICANN policy, and I wanted to use the chance here to present that to say this is going to affect the business of a number of people who are in this room.
I have a sort of supplementary, and that is in the UK specifically, we have a domain name which is .name.uk, where I can register Steve Dyer .me.uk. Yeah, it's my name. Now, I'm the Steve Dyer that lives at X address. I'm not the Steve Dyer who lives at another address. In other words, the definition of who the registrant is not just his name, it's also his address. And if you encourage people to make it very easy to change addresses, you stand the risk that some other Steve Dyer can hijack my name, because presumably you're going to say you can't change the registrant name, but you can change the registrant address. So I think this is quite a fraught area to encourage people to make changes.
I fully agree with you.
Thank you. Last question from Bill Murray.
What is the format of the mail that is required to be sent out, or is that left to the discretion?
It's left to the discretion of the registrar. It's not... there is no template for that, as opposed to the standard transfer process that is introduced in November. There you have it's called FOA, a form of form of authorization, I think. So additionally, that FOA has to be in English and maybe in other languages as an attachment.
I simply remember getting a couple of these things from a registrar that I continue to use in the format of the mail that I tend to read. And several months ago I was trolling through the trash where all the HTML formatted mail goes, and there were several pieces of mail complaining about the fact that I was not responsive. I don't run an HTML formatted mailer, so it might be prudent, if you're going to give any feedback about the format of the mail.
Okay, thank you, Bill. Guess we're done.
Okay, so last page. If you want to contact CORE, go to core.info or get a hold of me after the session. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Marcus. The last speaker or pair of speakers or the last topic for this morning is an update on the information about the right-hand CC host counts. And this presentation will be done jointly by Peter Koch and Heck Outerwall from RIPE NCC. Which presentation do I want first?
Mine.
Yeah.
Here we go. No, this is the top one.
Oops. Oh, we've done it wrong again. This one?
Yeah, that will work. Put on board for months.
Okay,
good morning everyone. I'm Hank Otterwell from RIPE NCC. I'm here to talk about the future of the RIPE NCC host counts. As some of you may know, the RIPE NCC has been counting the number of hosts on the internet based on DNS forever. It's a project we started around 1990. That makes it one of the longest time series on the internet around. Over the years, the focus changed a bit. We started with absolute size. It moved towards growth over time. For the last couple of years, this activity has been running as is. We had the software, we just ran it, updated the graphs, didn't do anything with it. So now it's time to revisit this activity. So why do we want to do this? Well, the number of hosts on the internet is interesting. It gives you some idea about coverage, things like that. Also interesting are the trends, so the first derivative or the difference over time, whatever you want to call it. That gives you an indication of how the net is growing. If there's a new technology picked up that requires more hosts, you can see it being picked up, and you can use it for all kinds of planning purposes. Also, you can take the data and split it out over regions or countries or whatever to see regional effects. Now, this makes it interesting. There are, however, some problems with this approach. First off, I will use the absolute number, but about everything I say about the absolute number also applies to the trends. Biggest problem we see at the moment is that zone data transfers are blocked by more and more sites. And that simply means that you can't you count what's in the zone to transfer the data, you don't count what's in the zones that do not allow you to get the data. So effectively you're counting a fraction of something that's unknown. So you're missing hosts. And that obviously makes the data less accurate and less useful. Another observation is that we have lots of other data sources that give you the same numbers and the same trends. One thing you can look at is BGP, how many hosts are there in the routing tables, allocation data, you can look at the inverse DNS tree, etc., etc. Other thing that's missing is the number of addresses used which do not correspond to a host in the DNS. We do not have a consistent error estimate procedure. And finally, we have a procedure to fix, to retroactively fix problems. For example, if we miss an entire zone for a month, we usually pick up the data from last month or something earlier. And we continue to use that. And that probably works, but it's not really statistically analyzed, and we have no idea how that affects the accuracy of the data. Some more questions you can ask about these efforts. Well, first one is, who is using this data? Okay, we collect it. That means that it takes time and resources at RepNCC to do it. Who's using the data? Well, all we know so far is we have about 1,500 visits to the websites per month, where 300 of those go deeper than just the first page of the website. We don't have any further insight in that. And that's something we want to look into. Related to that is what applications or who is using the data. And also the opposite question, okay, we have this data. We know people are interested in the numbers, so why aren't they using our data? And that relates to is the project getting the exposure that we want. So that's about the existing process. So a few words about other approaches. I think there are five ways to count this. There are two things that give an overestimate. Well, the first one is allocated addresses by the regional registries. Obviously, if an address is not allocated, it can't be used, so if you just count the number of addresses, Yes, you have a theoretical maximum of the number of hosts you can find on the internet. Probably another overestimate, but more accurate, is the BGP routing table. People will get a block of addresses and slowly start announcing blocks or sub-blocks of that on the net. And we have the host counts. That's an underestimate, as we just saw. Another underestimate is the inverse tree. So you can count that. Not everybody puts his data into the inverse tree. And finally, there are projects like Skitter, where people actually attempt to ping all the hosts on the internet. Has to be said that all these approaches are inaccurate. They all give estimates. The question is just which one gives the best estimate. And nothing on this slide is new. There are lots of projects around that used one or more over these techniques in the past. Obviously, all these data series are correlated. What has never been studied, or at least not been recently studied, is how they are correlated. My guess is, yes, they show the same. If you go down from top to bottom, you each get a fraction of the data, and the thing is probably shifted in time. As what will happen is that the site will apply for address space. It will then, after a little bit of time, announce the block in BGP, and then slowly populate the block with hosts and insert those into DNS and then in the inverse tree. But this is something that has to be studied as well. So, basically, this is the work we've done so far. We've sat down with a group of people at RIPNCC, just brainstormed on this, and the slides I just show you are a reflection of that. And we wrote it up, and there's a draft document of our discussions available at the URL shown on the screen. It's a draft document, actually. Yeah, we don't really know yet, and we haven't decided what we're going to do at the moment, but it's available to read, and we would like to invite interested parties to comment on it sort of in the next month. And based on this document, the feedback we get from the community, we want to make a more final plan what we want to do here sort of early November. And basically, this is what we think at the moment. We had all these questions about the data, and we want to investigate those. Perhaps do a prototype of a new tool based on one of the other techniques. And we also want to get a better estimate on the effort that RIPNCC needs to maintain this in the long run. The output of that should be a white paper, sort of giving options to the community what we will do with this activity. That's something I expect that it's available for discussion well before the RIPE50 meeting. And then after we had some community feedback, we want to look at phase two, which is essentially implement whatever comes out of the discussion with the community. Final thing I can say about this is that, okay, so far it has been a background task for various people at the RIPNCC, but there will be somebody available to work on this full-time from mid-October onwards. And that's all I wanted to say. So questions, and yeah, Peter is also going to add a few slides as one of the interested users, so perhaps we should take those first.
Okay. I would say that if there are any specific questions of what Henk has mentioned so far, we could take these now. But if there are more generic questions, maybe they could wait until after Peter's presentation. Okay. Peter.
Just a little bit. Here we go. So mostly I agree with what Henk already said, but I want just contribute some ideas to view at this host count from a different angle. So this is what this, well, it's not really a presentation, this sample of slides is about. I agree that we really do no longer count the number of hosts, and we do no longer even measure the growth of the network, whatever that is. Also, the resources spent to do the count and the time it needs is growing to an extent which, at least for me, is a bit uncomfortable because, well, DE having 8 million registered domains, of which roughly 6 million are delegated, takes round about 3 weeks for a complete cycle to count all the domains. And that's a fair amount of time and resources spent there. While at the same time, there is an inaccuracy introduced by that long time it runs. And as Hank already said, we don't see the whole picture anymore because of those lots of zone transfer blocks and other effects which hinder us from looking into it. But still we have access to a huge number of zones which we probably otherwise would not be able to see. That represents a fair amount of trust in so far as lots of operators are willing to open transfer for the what now is the right DNS host count, but usually would block the zone transfer. Read zone enumeration, DNSSEC, you'll know all about that discussion. We also have an established infrastructure for the data collection. The host count is a distributed effort supported by the RIPA NCC, but there are also a couple of volunteers involved, either from the registries or just curious individuals who count the data within their own domain. And, well, it's just there, so we could continue to do something with it and with all the people involved. Also, and that's my main point, if we are not only counting the hosts, we still have a huge amount of data which is interesting for, well, the DNS curious protocol surgeon or whatever you call that. That means if you are, say, interested in, well, we are talking about merit, we are talking about deployment of text records, we are probably talking about the deployment of Quad A records. It is interesting to see, well, given a certain top-level domain or given all the top-level domains in, say, Europe, how many records of type foo have been deployed yet and to what extent, what is being done with it? What is actually being done with the text records used in the European area? So can we deduce something useful from that for, say, or as, say, an input to maybe the IDF working groups or group work that is done in the RIPE working groups. We have a collected set of data from an otherwise completely decentralized data repository, which again can be used as input for further work. And in my opinion, there is a real necessity for having an eye on deployment and rollout of certain record types or of certain operational practices, like looking at, well, what are the people really doing with their TTLs, say, now that certain registries offer certain services which may or may not lead to lower default TTLs or things like that. So my summary is the RIPE DNS host count, despite its name, is no longer only about counting the machines. So while it may be useful, and I agree with Henk here, to set up a different approach and follow different paths for actually counting the numbers of machines, I would really like to continue and to urge the, say, fellow host counters or other people in this room to think about continuing this effort and of course maybe just change some things. So as I said, I'd like to continue this data collection. There could be concentrated efforts of inspecting the data for, well, configuration errors or just habits, as I said before. Deployment analysis is an important topic. What should probably be done is that the collection method be adjusted. As I said, it's not really that fun to have a collection system run 3 weeks per month. So it may be useful to somehow find out representative samples and just collect them and do estimates. Well, and then of course, also in this direction, when it's just about collecting the DNS data, alternative routes should be explored, as they always should. So this is just my 2 euro cents, and
2 euro cents, a couple of days a month.
For me?
It's a couple of days per month for you. It's not just 2 euro cents contribution.
Okay. Well, I don't have to sit 21 days besides it. Yeah, okay. So I would like... Wait, Jim, did you leave?
No.
Oh, you're in the back?
I was just hiding there.
Yeah, sure.
As usual.
I'm afraid of you. So you may open up the discussion.
Okay, let's open the discussion. Do you have any questions for observations
for Hank and for Peter?
Consensus that this is the right way forward. There's nobody here. Andrei
Rogachevsky, Ripen CC. I think, Peter, you actually opened a slightly different direction of HostCon.
Exactly.
Because in our understanding, HostCon was about estimating the size of the internet. And some other questions related to the size of the internet are what is actually what we would like to know about the size of the internet, right? Because it's not necessarily a number of hosts, perhaps. And also another question that we should consider, what is more important, absolute numbers or rather trends? Now, another comment regarding your direction or your dimension of host count is that if you would like to have some kind of data mining regarding DNS and regarding trends, like you would like to analyze number of resource records of a particular type or how deployment of resource record propagated over time. I think we can also use some statistical methods like used with polling and like, well, normal analysis. So we don't need to have a full data set.
Yes.
But we can like pick representative set of data and make this analysis. That has to be considered as well.
Yeah, sure.
Because otherwise you would end up in making DNS snapshots and keeping all these DNS snapshots over time to be able to produce data mining over a particular time series, creating particular time series, for instance. Because you haven't thought about this beforehand, and therefore you have to keep all the data.
Keeping the data has its own value. Like, do it from a perspective of a year 2500 internet historian, which is probably a bit too visionary now, but you probably get the direction. Part of this data collection is also keeping the, well, collective history of the DNS something, where we, well, probably do not really know who we do that for at the moment. I don't say that is the premier value of doing this, but mostly I agree. It's right what you said. It may be useful enough or sufficient to do the data collection with representative samples. Imposing the next question, how we find them? Is it just by randomly selecting domain names, or what do we do? Another point might be traffic analysis at certain points, at certain name servers, recursive servers or authoritative servers. But that gives us just another different picture.
Well, I understand. I think my question is rather, if one has a theory, right, and this theory has to be proved, then you conduct certain research, right? Though you can say, well, we don't have any theory at the moment, but we would like to have this data. So once we have a theory, we can prove or disprove the theory with this data bank we already collected. Is it what?
In other words, what you're saying is, if we use a statistical sampling,
If we use a statistical sampling now and we have another question to address in a few years' time, we might find out that our statistical sample was wrong and we have selection effects that prevent us from studying certain effects.
Well, sure, because I mean, statistical sampling assumes that or implies that you lose information, right? And you're not sure because you didn't set requirements ahead, right? You don't have a theory, you don't have requirements, and therefore you actually don't know what kind of information you have to collect.
Yeah, I think Andrew's hit the point in the head there. I think probably what we have to do here is give some consideration to the question of requirements as to what data we want to capture and why we want to capture it. And I think it would be very helpful if we could maybe consider further this topic and then perhaps have an action item for the working group to look at perhaps requirements on host sampling and gathering data. Hank?
Yeah, I agree with that. I mean since we're looking at an overhaul, I mean, it's... Well, at least we can at least consider additional requirements for data we should collect and store. I don't think we can guarantee anything at the moment, but at least if requirements are known, we can consider them.
Okay.
Yes, please.
Action item minute.
I think we should have an action item is we have to capture the requirements for statistics gathering. We'll leave this kind of open for now. I would ask if there's anybody here who's particularly interested in helping in putting these requirements together, because there might be a fair bit of work in doing this. If anyone's interested in doing that, could you please contact me sometime this week or sometime over the course of the next couple of weeks, and we can maybe try and get something done about it. I think the way forward is we might want to try and form some small working group, and that little, well, mini working group, if you can call it that, just some people get together on a mailing list, and then you can pick up some ideas for the requirements, and obviously we'll bring them back to the working group for discussion either at the next right meeting or through the mailing list itself. Okay, folks, I think we're done there for now. I'd like to say thanks very much to everybody. Special thank you to the presenters, and I'll see you all hopefully tomorrow morning. Let's go and get some coffee.
What you can do.